Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a few moments, pictures of prisoners from a notorious Iraqi jail highlight the need for Christians to be in the front line of the fight against torture. And the 2007 Templeton Prize winner says the secular and the spiritual must be taken seriously in the search to end problems of violence in contemporary society. Welcome to the programme. Shocking pictures in black and white, faces twisted in terror and pain, naked figures humiliated and abused. You may have seen such images before. They're taken from the photos of prisoners in Iraq's notorious Abu Ghraib jail, which seemed to shock the world when they were first published in the media and on internet, yet just a couple of years later have all but faded from the public consciousness. Pictures of man's and woman's inhumanity to man, which should be unthinkable in our 21st century democracies. Yet such practices are increasingly being justified as necessary tools in the global fight against terror.
I guess once these pictures were brought out in the open, and I kept thinking that America was going to take responsibility for what it did, that it would in some way acknowledge that there had been torture, that it was a systemic aspect of the system, you know, of the military system, and that they would try to do something to rectify this. And when it became clear that they were in fact going to become extremely legalistic, try to blame it on a few bad apples, I just felt it was intolerable.
American artist Susan Kreil was so struck by these shocking images, she wanted to make sure they did not disappear from public view, but remained as a permanent reminder of the need to step up the fight against torture today.
Torture is not something that is tolerable in this point in time. Never was, but I think that certainly now, particularly with the kind of internationalism that there is and the instruments that exist that make it possible to monitor such things, that it's just simply unacceptable. And I felt that I had to do whatever I could do to bring this to the attention of people. And the thing about photographs such as the ones that were taken at Abu Ghraib is that there's a way in which they horrify and then they're tossed out and thrown away and sort of become a vestige, a memory way in the past.
Kreil has created a collection of drawings which portray in simple chalk strokes all the humiliation and dehumanization that went on behind those prison walls. Yet beyond these stark images, her portraits also depict the full fragility of the human condition, and many reflect a strong spiritual sense, with figures stretched out or hung like a modern-day Christ on the cross.
I felt that if I could find a way to do it in drawing, in something more durable, something that has texture and the feeling that you get from art materials, that it might have a way of getting into the consciousness of people and staying there a little longer.
Do you think that the average man or woman on the street in America today shares your horror at what happened at Abu Ghraib? Do you think it is becoming part of the consciousness, or are people in fact more willing to accept torture today than they were, say, before 9/11?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword in an odd kind of way. I think on the one hand there is a horror about it, but there's then a way in which that horror is being incorporated into the culture itself. I think that the kinds of things we're seeing in the media and in movies where torture has clearly become much more acceptable, and I think the very fact that torture has become real torture on real time in real media has become a standard that we see and are exposed to. But I don't think people like to think of themselves in America, which has always had a kind of moral position in the world, that we are doing this. I don't think a lot of people like it.
What is your message through these pictures to people who perhaps are interested but would like to do something more?
I think it's that ultimately we have to acknowledge our humanity, that we are all human, and that everybody has a right to their dignity. It does not matter what anybody has done, they have a right to some dignity.
Kreil's work is on show here in Rome at a Trastevere museum, next door to the St. Egidio lay community headquarters. The exhibition was inaugurated on June the 26th, the date celebrated around the world as the UN's Day Against Torture. This year, the observance also marked the 20th anniversary of the UN Convention Against Torture, which has been ratified by over 140 nations. Over these two decades, prevention mechanisms have been set up and laws have been introduced at national and international levels to stop the use of cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment of prisoners. Yet according to many observers, the war on terrorism is increasingly undermining that process to ban torture on both legal and moral grounds.
Half of the countries in the world still practice torture, unfortunately, but I think the big deal now with the fight against torture is that it's a pity that democracies started again to practice torture.
Sylvie de Pontoile is president of FIACAT, the International Federation of Christians for the Abolition of Torture.
They contribute to build the human rights fields and the absolute prohibition of torture. But since the 11th September, now they feel that they have to fight against terrorism. And to fight against terrorism, they think that the practice of torture is a useful tool. Of course, they are wrong to think about this. And because of that, idea, they thought, and especially the first of the democracy, United States, thought that perhaps torture is a useful tool to fight against the terrorism. So I think, we think in FIACAT, International Federation, and all the national organization of FIACATs, we think that the art is a good mean to fight against torture, because it's very simple for people to understand very efficiently that torture is legally and especially morally prohibited, because it dehumanized people, dehumanized human beings. Because of the people fear of terrorism, they think that they could perhaps support the government to practice torture, because they thought that, well, terrorist people are not so human as we are, you know, and we would like to fight against this feeling in our European countries, in our Western countries.
You represent the Federation of Christians specifically against torture. What particular role do you think the church plays here in getting this message across?
For us, it's very important because, first, as Christian, we have to go after Christ and the example of the Christ. Or the Christ is the figure who is tortured, in fact, on the cross. So we think that Christian people could understand how torture is so horrible, is so dehumanizing people. Then we think also that Christ delivered a message of love to our enemies. And perhaps the art of this message now and nowadays is that terrorist people are our enemies. In fact, they are our enemies. They would like to destroy our societies, our values, especially Christian values, because they fight against Christianity and so on. And we think that to leave exactly the message of gospel, we have to treat these people as we would like that we would be treated ourselves, you know. We wouldn't like that our values of dignity, of human rights, of civil liberties, well, all things which are founded our democracy, we wouldn't like that they should be destroyed by this fight against the war of terror. And we think also that as a Christian organization, churches, of course, Catholic churches, because we are in Roma, in the heart of the Catholic world, but not as only Catholic Church, also all the Protestant churches and also the Orthodox churches, all the world of Christianity, they have to show example to the rest of the world, because we have to send to the world a message of fraternity, not only solidarity. For me, solidarity is just human, but fraternity is the message that Christ delivered to each people, even the worst man as a terrorist one. Why? Because as Christian, we have a message of forgiveness. We should say to everybody, well, you do very bad thing, but you know, God loves you. God welcomes you if you ask him his forgiveness. Perhaps you can, in the future, you can be a better man or woman. We feel that very strong, and so churches and Christian people can tell this message to the all of the world.
What exactly would you like to see Christians doing to become more involved in this struggle? How would you like them to be trying to spread this message?
Especially first, as the International Federation, I'm waiting for a common and very strong message from all the churches together. In fact, actually, we have a message from the ecumenical organization. We have a message from the Catholic Church, from Pope John Paul II, and now from Pope Benedictus XVI. But we didn't have, until now, a common message from them, the two of them. And we would like to get this common message, because we think that if, as Christian churches, they speak as one voice, it's much, much more stronger to the world to be listened.
Looking at the pictures in this exhibition, what would you say is the most striking thing about these shocking images?
Well, for us, it's much more, these pictures are much, much more strong than the photograph we saw and which are spread all over the world. Why? Because the photograph are just showed the reality, just brutal reality. So it's horrible, and it didn't let any hope. But these pictures are different. They are very tough. Of course, they are very tough. It's hard to show, to see, and to have a look at them. But they show, in one part, the inhumanity, but in the other part, the humanity of the looking of the painter, you know. And it's a call, it's a sort of a call to us who are looked on these pictures. Well, you have to stay human. You have to keep and to fight for the respect of dignity, of human dignity, even for all these men. So for me, this picture brings a message of hope in humanity, you know, and it calls an appeal to everybody to fight against these practices of torture.
thanks there to Sylvie de Pontoise, president of the International Federation of Christians for the Abolition of Torture. And earlier you heard American artist Susan Kreil, whose exhibition entitled Abu Ghraib, Abuse of Power, is on show at the Museo di Roma in Trastevere in Piazza Sant'Egidio until September the 30th. The prestigious Templeton Prize for Research into Spiritual Realities is normally awarded to mathematicians, astronomers, physicists, and those who study the ways in which science and faith interact. Given annually, this award is the largest monetary prize, worth more than the Nobel Awards, to highlight the importance of progress in spiritual subject matters. The 2007 award, however, was presented to Canadian Catholic philosopher and author Charles Taylor from Northwestern University in Illinois, who has spent nearly half a century arguing that problems of violence in modern society can only be resolved by tackling both their secular and spiritual dimensions. Born in Montreal in 1931, Taylor grew up in a Catholic home where both English and French were spoken, sparking an early interest in questions of identity within a pluralist society. It was while he was studying philosophy at Oxford University that he first encountered what he describes as an unstructured hostility towards religious belief. That, in turn, led him to question the so-called objective approaches of psychology, history, linguistics, and the social sciences. And if that all sounds very philosophical and rather unscientific, well, Professor Taylor told me the Templeton Award aims to further all studies that can help break down barriers between faith and reason.
It's implicit in the whole idea of Sir John Templeton that one wants to break down this artificial barrier between sciences of any kind, discipline studies of any kind, and spirituality, that the same kind of considerations could arise about the humanities and social sciences. And maybe even, in a sense, more urgently, because I think that our humanities and social sciences in many countries in the West, and Anglo-Saxon countries in particular, have been very often construed narrowly, let's put it that way, by practitioners who have thought they could more or less ignore religion as something that, belonged to the past, or see it as not really important in the explanation of what human beings do.
Now, you've spent most of your career, haven't you, insisting on the need to include a spiritual dimension into the public debate, quite a countercultural position for British society. Do you feel there's been a change recently in public opinion that is coming more round to your views now?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there was a narrative, as it were, a secularization narrative that was there in the background, that religion belonged to the past, that modernity automatically leads to a decline in religion, and so you can ignore it more and more. And I think that the last 20 years have really badly shaken that, and people have reacted differently to this, of course, but it's just not possible to say that it doesn't affect us, or it's not something that's still very, very living and very important. You may be very against it. You may think that it's appalling that this is happening, but you can't really just ignore it. So there's begun to be a shift. It's very slow because, academic disciplines are very, very conservative, but there is beginning to be a change.
Would you say that recently it's above all the rise in Islamic fundamentalism, perhaps, that is provoking this serious re-evaluation of the role of religion in public life?
Yeah, it's not the only thing, but I think it's probably the most important one, yeah. And in a certain sense, this is, I think, posing a real cultural and spiritual crisis for the West, because it's possible to respond to this in a way which is totally hostile to religion as such, in this case to Islam as such, and to clutch on to tremendously simple and homogenized views of Islam as something, is essentially behind this kind of terrorist attack, as against understanding how tremendously varied and internally complex the Islamic world is, and so on. And I find it very worrying that a lot of public opinion in the West and in a lot of media and in a lot even of scholars who should know better, we find this kind of Islamophobia being fed and encouraged.
You're talking about the urgent need for new insight, aren't you, into
yes.
the human propensity for violence. But as you know, of course, religions, all religions, were and are still seen by many people as part of the problem.
Yes.
Are church leaders, therefore, or faith leaders in general, able, do you think, to transcend these past problems and offer any real insight or guidance?
Oh, I think undoubtedly, yes. I mean, for one thing, it's clear that much religion has been behind a lot of violence, or then much atheist ideology has been behind violence. And then many religious leaders have been very firmly on the side of attempting to overcome violence, to find peaceful solutions and to these problems. So there are people in both type of ideologies, if you like, in more faith positions, who are on both sides. And we have great tradition in the Christian church of people who have been working for peace. So we just have to build on those and make them our central understanding of our faith, and also, you know, repudiate those elements in our past which tell against this. I think one of the great things about John Paul's pontificate was that he was really willing to make this tremendously clear that we deeply regret those passages in our past that, in a sense, betrayed our commitment to peace as Christians.
Yet the Catholic Church tends to look at such violent episodes in the past by saying that individual people may have sinned, but the Church itself cannot be blamed for such violence. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that that's something very hard for people to understand. I mean, there's a certain sense of the church which is always God's church, which is a very deep theological notion, and therefore which in a way stands beyond all this. But most people don't understand that theological distinction. They think of how institutions operate. And when they see Pope Urban II preaching the crusade, you know, it's very hard for them to say, well, what do you mean there's no institutional responsibility here. I think that was a rather foolish thing to say. I mean, unless you can give the whole world a really deep understanding of Christian theology and the nature of the church, it needs to be put in a much more nuanced way than that.
You're talking about the important role of charismatic leaders. You mentioned Gandhi or Mandela or Archbishop Tutu, for example. How much
yes.
do you think, then, that the acceptance of religion in public life today really depends upon people like this?
Oh, a great deal. I mean, people who otherwise might be very hostile are really brought up short when they you know, meet a figure like Tutu or any of these figures. So I think that a great part of the message, as it were, of the Church of the World passes through figures like that who can really turn people around who have otherwise sharing these very harsh prejudices against religion and against the church and so on. Suddenly it gets through to them that there's something more to it than that when they read or meet figures like that.
You're very interested in this whole phenomenon of secularization, aren't you, and the rise of what you call new forms of religious belief and practice.
Yes.
What exactly do you mean here?
Well, I think that there are a tremendous variety of religious or spiritual or halfway between sort of religious and non-religious positions that are growing all the time. And it's a tremendous variety of atheist positions. I mean, if you think of the influence of Nietzsche over the last century and how that adds, you know, totally different themes to the ones that we had in the old forms of unbelief from Voltaire and Gibbon and so on. You can see that on both sides, and in the middle, there's constantly new positions that were not even imagined by our ancestors. Now, these are not only being propounded, they are all finding some degree of support, not some very, very small, some larger. I think that is going to be a feature, continuing feature of modern culture, that any faith position is going to have to swim in a sea of extremely diverse denizens and be able to speak to that.
And yet, of course, the established, the older churches tend to look at these new forms of religious belief as something of a threat rather than an ally. Does this kind of attitude worry you?
Yes. I don't think it's going to be fruitful, or from even evangelization point of view, it's going to be fruitful. What one has to do, I think, is to, of course, criticize other positions that are, you know, one really thinks are not correct, but also to have a sympathetic understanding of what moves people into those positions, so that you can speak to these very deep impulses in people and you know, partial insights that people have that have put them in those positions. And if you just stand outside and condemn in the old way, you're cutting off a very, very vital dialogue.
You were brought up a Catholic, weren't you, in your native
Yes.
Canada. How much did your own faith, or has your own faith, inspired your work over the years?
Oh, in a way, totally. I mean, it's been the thing that somehow is at the core of the whole thing. You have to, if you're doing this kind of work, you have to have, you're always moved by some very fundamental insights, which are very terribly vague at the beginning and not very much less vague now, maybe, but that push you forward and you try to define further. And mine have been totally bound up with my Christian faith, Catholic faith.
Pope Benedict and his predecessor John Paul II have also had a lot to say about the dangers of divorcing faith from reason or scientific inquiry. Are you very much encouraged then by these papal documents, these speeches?
Yes, I am. I mean, I have certain differences with the actual ways of formulating them and so on, but that basic line is one that I absolutely, entirely agree with. I mean, I think my take on it is that we have to rediscover how broad and plural reason is. It's not simply a set of procedures of, you know, logical deduction and so on. It has much more to it than that. If we go back to Plato, you can see that. And I think we have to really redefine what people understand as reason, which is far too narrow in our intellectual culture.
And my thanks there to Canadian Catholic philosopher and Professor Charles Taylor, the recipient of the 2007 Templeton Prize for Research into Spiritual Realities. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme of Vatican Radio. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. And don't forget, you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Once again, that's www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, do stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.